This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
We've got Dan Ammerman coming back on the show today. I wanted to reach out to him and get him back, given all of the absolute craziness that's going on in the world. As you know, he's been on several times, and many of you have taken his Turning Inflation into Wealth course that I took about 12 years ago or so. But hey, I wanted to play a quick little clip from our private podcast that's part of the JHU membership, because this totally applies to a search I did yesterday proving the actual non-theoretical practice of supply-demand shock, something we've been talking about. This is very significant. So this clip will tee up the supply-demand shock issue that I want to talk to you about before we get to today's guest. And that's when they coined the term the misery index. Jimmy Carter probably hated that, I'm sure. But do you have any thoughts about that?
I see economic growth in a lot of different ways. So right now, supply is low. We have low inventories. It's all been sucked dry out of the system. And so that's where I think the inflation is going to come in, is rebuilding those stockpiles, and the demand is going to come online faster than supply. That's where the inflation comes in. Stagflation, you know, it's interesting you talk about that, because for a couple of years now, I have been on the sidelines cheerleading an infrastructure bill. You know, to me, coming in with something that is, you know, a la post-World War II in the 50s under Eisenhower, where you really come in and you're really pumping money into things that matter, to me, that launched a couple of generations of economic life in the U.S. And so I've been sitting here on the sidelines saying, you know, we've got a president who knows development. Right. Why don't we have – there was even some preliminary chat approximately 2 years ago where Pelosi came in and they talked infrastructure bill. And as usual, you know, yeah, it sounds good in theory, but when you've got two different sides of the equation trying to figure it out, it doesn't come together. Well, now we've got a crisis. And in the words of Rahm Emanuel, don't let a crisis go to waste.
So yesterday, I had to go find some supply demand shock of my own. And why is this so significant? Well, as I've been telling you since the beginning of this crisis, this is a rare economic malady, and it's one that we really saw very significantly in the 70s. It's one of the reasons we started talking about the misery index, the Jimmy Carter misery index. And the misery index, of course, is high inflation and high unemployment at the same time. It's miserable. It's terrible. It's like when you're out and about and you've got nice warm weather, but it's really humid and sticky, and it makes it miserable, right? If you had just had one without the other, it'd be okay. You can live with inflation as long as the economy is booming, and you can live with high unemployment as long as everything's cheap and prices are low. But when you get both together, you have the misery index. It's miserable. It's miserable. So check this out, supply-demand shock. Remember, this all happens like everything in the economy. There's a lag time, right? There's a lag time. So what happened? Well, at the beginning of the crisis, travel demand absolutely collapsed. Airline demand just collapsed. Nobody would fly. Everybody was either scared to fly or events were being canceled, so there was no reason to fly. Meetings were being canceled, conferences were being canceled, et cetera, et cetera. We even canceled our Meet the Masters conference, and then we canceled our Venture Alliance Mastermind retreat. We had both of those events scheduled. We canceled them both. So happening to everybody, right? Well, At first, after the crisis began, airline tickets were super cheap. Why? Because there was lots of supply and demand had totally collapsed. Well, what happens after the suppliers adjust, the supply side economics, if you will, to use a well-worn phrase from the Reagan era, supply side economics, when you collapse the demand, eventually, it takes a little time, the suppliers react. So what did the airlines do? They started grounding planes, they canceled routes, they parked their planes in storage. Okay, there are pictures online you can see of jet after jet after jet, 737s, 747s, Airbus planes. You can see them sitting in giant, basically aircraft parking lots, right? And they're just sitting there. They're idle. They're doing nothing. These planes are just shut down. Same with rental cars, by the way. Sarah, our investment counselor, I think it was her, posted a picture on her Facebook page just a week ago or so of Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles full of cars. The parking lot is full. Well, it's not because anybody's going to a baseball game. There are no baseball games. It's because the rental car companies parked their cars at Dodger Stadium. They've been using that as a big parking lot, and I'm sure many other parking lots all around the world, because the cars aren't on the road. So the suppliers start reducing supply. Now, this is what's going to be the big supply-demand shock in the oil market. And I interviewed James Altucher yesterday. We'll play that episode next week, James Altucher. And we talked about oil supply-demand shock. So that's coming up, but hugely significant, right? The demand collapses, then the supply collapses. Oil companies go out of business because oil's so cheap, right? There's no demand. So first oil gets cheap, then oil companies figure, well, we can't stay in business at these prices. So they stop producing. And then you get into a recovery mode and there's no supply. So you have supply shock. First you have demand shock, then you have supply shock. Well, here's a real-world example with airlines. Okay, I went to Google Flights, and I searched a flight that's sort of a simple route, a flight from Miami to LAX, Miami to Los Angeles. Now, the interesting thing is, on Google Flights, you can look at the price history for the last 60 days, and the chart does not lie. This ticket is very expensive now. And I just remember, although I didn't take a screenshot, unfortunately, I should have, anecdotally, I searched this route a few weeks ago and it was very cheap. And the chart shows me that. So 60 days ago, this flight would cost you about $260. That's pretty reasonable. But guess what? 30 days ago, you could buy this flight for around $50. $50. It costs nothing to fly. Round trip, Miami, LAX, and coming back. But now that same flight is $437. $437. So this is so inflationary because the normal, if you will, although there's no such thing as normal in the airline business, the normal cost of that flight, about $260, $275. Okay, goes down super cheap when the demand collapses to $50. Now, the supply has also collapsed and it's $437. Great example of supply-demand shock. I know it's not totally perfect. This is not some scientific survey. It's just me going to Google Flights. You do not need to send me a bunch of emails poking holes in the theory. The concept holds true. Okay, so don't bother me about it, because I know there's like 10 people listening that are anxious to poke holes in my theory. Okay. Anyway, that's the concept of supply-demand shock. It is a critical thing to understand because we're going to see it, and I think we come out of this into a smaller economy for a long time. We come out of this into stagflation, and we come out of this into a mass migration to cheap suburban areas where people can rent a home and not have an elevator, and they can socially distance and all of that stuff. So we're here to help you with that. JasonHartman.com/properties for our properties that are available now, or contact an investment counselor. And you can always call us 1-800-HARTMAN. Without further ado, let's get to our guest, Dan Ammerman. And guess what? Next week, you know what I can't wait to tell you? I can't wait to tell you to ask for a discount the next time you order food from one of these restaurants or buy a product from one of these retailers, because I'm going to tell you who's not paying their rent. That'll come up next week. Okay, here is returning guest Dan Ammerman. It's my pleasure to welcome back Daniel Ammerman. He is a returning guest who I've been following for many, many years. He's been on the show many, many times, as you regular listeners know. And I originally found his material, Turning Inflation into Wealth. And he has evolved a lot over the years with different materials. Lately, he's working on crisis investing. Let's welcome him back. Dan, how are you?
Good, Jason. Thanks for having me back.
The pleasure is ours, and you are coming to us from your hometown, Minneapolis, and you've basically got a ranch out there, don't you? Or the equivalent, where you've got an easy place to socially distance, right?
Yeah, I'm a little bit north of Minneapolis, so yeah, I've got a few thousand acres of wilderness kind of out the back door here. It's social distancing is not difficult.
It's nice and easy. And as my listeners know, and I just mentioned to you before we started, I think there will be literally a tsunami of migration to lower density living environments. And that's not your area, but your area definitely is monetary and fiscal policy, and tying it in with taxation as well. Dan, give us the macro picture. There's more than enough to talk about. Take it where you want it. What's going on?
Well, I feel in some ways this comes back around to when you and I first met. You attended one of my workshops, and I think it was maybe June of 2008. And we were on the verge of the financial crisis.
In Newport Beach, California, by the way.
Beach, California. And among the topics, besides real estate asset liability management, was the dangers of a derivatives-based financial meltdown, how the federal government would probably try to contain that with spending. And if the amounts got too great where they couldn't do that, the Federal Reserve would probably create the money to deal with it. And sure enough, 4 months later, where were we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first quantitative easing.
Right. QE1.
Indeed. And that was the creation of a little over $400 billion in the course of a week, which was absolutely unprecedented. And that changed in that very moment that happened. That really did change the nature of money. And it also changed the nature of investments. And this is something I have been developing and working on ways of explaining to people for many years now. What I'm currently calling it is cycles of crisis and the containment of crisis. That is, in the aftermath of the financial crisis of 2008, the world was never the same. A lot of the investment universe, interest rates, the housing market, they were all based upon this massive amount of monetary creation the Federal Reserve had done for the first time that was being used to artificially lower interest rates, which, of course, over time did really strong things for real estate. And if you look back to the first, what I call the first crisis, when things really changed, which is the collapse of the tech stock bubble in 2001.
Yeah, right. So the dot-com bubble.
Then you had the first containment of crisis when the Federal Reserve slammed interest rates down to 50-year lows, and that greatly facilitated the growth of that real estate bubble. So if you look at real estate and what real estate prices have done over the last 20 years, I would argue that it is the two cycles of containment of crisis that have dominated the markets, because each time extremely low mortgage rates have been created, each of those times that's made housing far more affordable, whether we're talking about living in a house or whether we're talking about purchasing an investment property. And that has fundamentally changed the trajectory of things. It's also fundamentally changed bond prices, and it has fundamentally changed stock prices.
Okay, so
the last 20 years on average, we've had the lowest PE ratios we've ever seen.
And one of the things you said that I just want to ask you to elaborate on, you said it made housing and investment properties more affordable, right?
Correct.
Right. Now, that's one of the things that just of many things in the mainstream media, Dan, that just drive me crazy. You see these charts that tell only one component of the story. I'm sure they drive you crazy too, where a chart of real estate prices, for example, mm-hmm. number one, it's not divided up by market type or any geographical thing, which also is important, but just assume that real estate prices were one monolithic idea, right? Which they're not. But assume they are. Just give them that for a second. They just go by the price. They don't go by the price of the monthly payment. Almost nobody considers the price of the property or the house just based on the price. They look at it on the payment. That's how they buy. And mortgage payments are actually not high at all. even though prices are higher, and they all say, oh, well, the market's in for a crash because the prices are back to their pre-bubble peak, depending on how they slice it and dice it and whatever. Mm-hmm. You'll hear stuff like that, and it's just a non sequitur. It's just not enough information.
Yeah, I'm pulling up the information right now. You may recall, Jason, that I'm, besides enjoying talking, I'm also a numbers guy, and I do a lot of visual illustrations.
Yes, and you do a great job of it.
Yep. I have many hundreds of graphs all the times that explain the different things that I feel are important and that are being missed. And if you take a look at average mortgage payments mm-hmm. on an inflation-adjusted basis for equivalent homes, we are still close to historic lows other than just a few years ago. But if you look at any time in history, basically – yeah, before 2000, we're almost off the bottom of the scale.
Right? So in other words, average house payment is, except for one point a few years ago, average house payment
got much lower right after the financial crisis of 2008 when it got much lower than it is right now.
Right.
And that has some lessons for us in terms of Federal Reserve policies to try to contain this larger crisis this time around.
Okay, so when was that low point that you mentioned? Was it like 2012, 13?
Well, the very bottom was 2012.
That's when houses were the cheapest of all. And I believe I said on my podcast that the Housing Affordability Index was the lowest since they've been publishing the index, which I believe was 1972.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've got the same data here.
Right,
and it's just unmistakable. Mm-hmm. But right now, if I looked at the particular model I was using has an average inflation-adjusted payment, mortgage payment between 1975 and 2019 dollars of $1,446.
Yeah.
And we're down probably 1,100 right now, something like that.
Mm-hmm. It's
so well below that average.
And the other thing, Dan, and this is harder to quantify, but that house has probably gotten better too, hasn't it? Because more modern houses better than an older house almost every time. So we look at these stats of the size of the house has increased. Now, granted, the density has also increased. And that's what I think is faulty about saying, the post-World War II baby boomer house was 1,000 square feet or whatever, and now it's 2,200, right? So,
I use the Freddie Mac Housing Price Index, which is pairs-based.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is that compensates for that.
Okay, good.
So this takes a look at the equivalent of, in this case, a 2017 home, mm-hmm. which would have been a mansion by 1975 standards.
Sure,
By the time you got to average. It also takes into account, changing amenities, changing square footage. And the other factor that really changes over time is that a greater percentage of the population now lives in higher cost areas.
Right.
That it used to, and that skews it as well. So you have to take that into account. But these numbers do take that into account.
How do you account for that? That's really interesting. How do you account for, the neighborhood? That's a really tough one to account for. The square footage is easier. Now, the thing they always leave out of that, though, is the land. I take Lakewood, California as this sort of, outside of Long Beach where I used to live, is this like perfect post-World War II suburban baby boom area. And granted, the house was small, but you did have a big yard. Now you've got no yard or a tiny yard, but you've got a bigger square footage house itself. You can do that. How do you quantify for neighborhood? That's a toughie.
Well, I've got a pretty good idea of how they do it. Freddie Mac does not fully disclose what goes on there. But the basis of pairs-based comparisons are that you're looking at the prices for the same home, when ideally it sells at different points in time. Sometimes they use refinancings as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You get an independent appraisal of it according to their standards. What appears that they're doing in terms of adjusting for the movements from, say, small towns in Iowa and Nebraska to Florida, Arizona, California, as the case may be, is as far as I can tell, what they're doing is they are periodically reweighting based on population shifts.
Mm-hmm.
So they change the index if there's a net flow of population, and as there has been, let's say from less expensive Rust Belt and Midwestern locations to Sun Belt locations.
Quite a difference. Okay, good. I didn't mean to go too far off on that tangent. That was definitely one. What else did you want to know?
Jason, you just can't get me going on top.
I know. It's super interesting.
Not a good
idea. Me too. What else do you want listeners to know? Maybe a whole other aspect of what's going on. What the Fed is doing is absolutely mind-boggling.
And it's not just mind-boggling. It is a one-way street. That's the issue. And we've known that this process was going on. The second containment of crisis, where the Fed was using QE, was much stronger than the first round of containment of crisis. It was much more pervasive. But the Federal Reserve was never able to exit it. They never could unwind their balance sheet. They had to keep the trillions there. They never could totally escape from the very low interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll recall, they tried in 2017,
right.
2018.
They couldn't do it. Yeah.
They nearly crashed the market December of 2018, and then they totally backed off. So the deeper they go down this path, it's like going into a lobster trap.
So
you can go in, but you can't come out.
Yeah, I know. Like, what's the end game? Is there a reset, a debt jubilee? I mean, it's not just the end game for the Fed. It's the end game for almost every government on earth. It's the end game for the consumers, the people, the companies. I mean, we just live in a world of debt and derivatives. I mean, will that just be that way forever, or does it have to reset at some point?
There are different directions they can go. One of them, if we start with the assumption, and it's not the only assumption, of ongoing free markets and freedom, individual liberties, then it blows apart at some point. The alternative is that we go to ever more political control and ever more of a command economy. And you can create the simulation of ongoing stability, even though on a reality basis, you probably have lower and lower standards of living and higher rates of inflation, based on what we've seen.
And do you just move into this kind of Japan-style lost economy, this like anemic economy, when debt levels and such get just too far out of hand to where you just can't kind of really grow your way out of it? It just sort of plods along forever.
Yeah, that's a possibility. But the issue with that is, and I think we're going to be coming up on this as well, and this pandemic, and not just the pandemic, but the responses to it help bring this forward as well. It's not just the economic side, it's the political side.
Okay.
And Japanification is a very real scenario for a period of time. But if there is substantial political change, that is less likely to persist. Mm-hmm. If the U.S. goes full on socialist, for instance,
and you know,
there would
just
be no need for Japanification.
It just seems like no matter what anybody says, we're moving toward an era of just much, 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 much greater government involvement in the economy. I think this is going to be a good push toward universal basic income, toward a nationalized housing assistance program. This is a monumental shift we're going through right now.
This is not a push towards, Jason. Yeah. This is what's happening right now. As we look at this rollout of this $2.3 trillion, I think it is, in new Fed financing programs all across the board, we are seeing a fundamental redefinition of our economy happening right now in real time that is, in my opinion, strongly biased against entrepreneurs and small businesses and strongly skewed towards large corporate and governmental organizations.
Okay.
You know, that's where that money is going to.
It seems like the entrepreneurs wouldn't, and small businesses, well, it depends on the type of small business, mm-hmm. but it doesn't seem like they would be as hard hit. I was just thinking you were going to say more concentration of wealth, more inequality, definitely more wealth at the top, less mm-hmm. at the bottom. But I sort of didn't necessarily think the entrepreneurs would be as affected by that. You know, they have the ability to change their circumstances to an extent, right? But the typical worker bee, especially in the lower socioeconomic strata, they're just going to get poorer. It's sad. It's already terrible as it is. I mean, you know, we just, in 2017, we saw the first real dollar wage increases in four decades, right? And that's real dollars based on official inflation stats, which are different from reality, as we both know. But what do you think about that?
Well, I guess I'm defining entrepreneur a somewhat different way than you are.
Yeah.
I'm not looking at a capitalist mm-hmm. who's out there investing money in the way that you mean. I'm looking at who owns virtually every local restaurant around that's not a chain.
Yeah, right, right. In that sense, you're absolutely
right. You go up and down
right.
the street, yeah. you go by any strip shopping mall, you go by anything like that. You have small business after small business after small business, and you do have the increase in unemployment insurance that's at least temporarily going to the workers. You have a very efficient flow of money, and this is just, again, Jason, this is the last 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and this is unveiling day by day. You have a massive flow of money to major corporations. And you have a massive flow of money to large cities and states, but not small cities at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just what I've been reading is they're searching for, and they don't really have a good method to push that money out to the small businesses.
Okay, so how does that tie in with UBI, Universal Basic Income?
Well, what that does is that basically wipes out employment for a good part of the population because quite a few people work for those small businesses.
Right, sure.
And, you know, it's hard for them to come back from that basis. Instead, the economy consolidates some more. And I would argue it's been deeply unfair for some time now in that the major corporations have access to far lower cost liabilities than individuals or small entrepreneurs do?
In translating that, you mean they can just get fantastic cheap or free debt, right?
Yes, yeah. They can borrow at 1-3%.
Which in real terms is getting paid to borrow. It's negative
yes,
interest rates
yes,
because
yes.
by the time they take the tax deduction on the interest and by the time inflation happens, even when it's super moderate, they're getting mm-hmm. paid to borrow the money.
Whereas the average consumer's 17-18% on a credit card. You know,
yeah.
there's a huge discrepancy there. And this is, I think, as we amplify here, that's just going to get greater.
I think, sadly, you're right. What action should people be taking now?
This is something I've been writing about regularly. I already did have a full-length free book out. You can sign up for it on my website, danielammerman.com, called Cycles of Crisis and the Containment of Crisis. And I think what we're looking for probably first and foremost is just understanding that right now, April of 2020, we're in a very different place than we've been before. And it's going to be difficult to go back. And when we look at any investment decision of any kind, be it investment property, be it some other form of real estate, be it stocks or bonds, the role of the federal government, the national debt, Federal Reserve policy, Federal Reserve balance sheet, their liability structure is all crucially important for determining investment results. And probably a lot of people hearing that would say, that's crazy talk. That's absolutely crazy talk.
Right.
That's not how we look at investments.
Yeah.
We look back and we look at prices over time in inflation-adjusted terms, and we look at P/E ratios, and we look at, you know, what asset class performed well in this decade or that decade and so forth and so on. But the problem is that historical information all becomes, for lack of a better term, garbage to the extent you're looking at what's happening with prices when we have a Federal Reserve-dominated market with an extraordinary national debt, each of which produce these just distorting waves that go out and change everything.
Oh, I almost don't have a comment, really, for once in my life. It's so absolutely amazing. Dan, one of the things I think your students and my students struggle with is the way to distinguish inflation in terms of asset price inflation and consumer price inflation. You know, the age-old question, do we have inflation? Or how much is inflation? What is the real inflation rate? Can you dive into that a bit and just unpack that for us a bit?
course, I think about it mathematically, and it is, I think, difficult for most people to follow that, particularly if you're verbally describing mathematics. But what happens is that inflation itself is inherently deceptive in terms of you have something that is worth less and less, and that is expressed by there being more and more of it. And that's just confusing. If you have $200 or you can sell something for $200, that looks like you have more of it. But the reason it sells for $200 is because a dollar is only worth 50 cents compared to what it used to be. Now, let's take that and let's go a little bit further. Let's say that something becomes worth $200 instead of $100. Well, most people say you've made $100, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the IRS definitely says you made $100.
Right, because one of the things you taught me early on was that the IRS doesn't know how to calculate inflation for its own benefit. It ignores it. But sometimes investors benefit from that too.
They can.
Yeah.
They can. But yeah, something to keep in mind about inflation, and none of this is an accident. The Federal Reserve creates inflation as a matter of governmental policy, and the Internal Revenue Service does not see inflation as a matter of governmental policy. And that means actual tax rates are quite a bit higher than what is disclosed. That very consistently applies. But that was kind of an aside there. To get back to the example, if we had an asset that was worth $100 and it became worth $200 as a result of price inflation, then to most people, it looks like you've doubled your money, right? If a dollar had become worth 50 cents, you'd still have $100 in purchasing power.
Right, so you didn't double your money.
But let's say that a dollar became worth a quarter, then your purchasing power has gone down to $50.
Right.
So that is an example of price inflation, a change in the value of money, and asset deflation, a decrease in the value of the asset. And the most recent analysis I just put out a couple days ago, I took a look at what we had seen last time we had a simultaneous inflation shock, which there's a good chance it could turn out this way in terms of the hit to the supply chain and so forth, and a drastic increase in unemployment. And that was the 1970s. And that was actually a perfect example of high rates of price inflation. You can call it monetary inflation. Some people say that's the supply of money, but you don't need to get that esoteric. And asset deflation. Because over the 14 years between 1968 and 1982, it looks like the Dow Jones just barely lost money, but it was in fact off by 70%. Most people don't realize that. Last time around, we had this combination of circumstances. The market in a secular bear market, meaning long-term, meaning more than 10 years, lost 70% of its value, and that was almost entirely hidden by money losing 65% of its value.
Isn't that just amazing? And
it was dominating.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a little numerical trick.
This was
reality for an entire generation of stock investors, particularly if they were close to retirement age.
And it is something that people really just don't notice properly. It is the best method of wealth redistribution. Taxation is a very obvious method of wealth redistribution, but inflation is tricky. It's sneaky, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the really interesting things about real estate asset liability management strategies that is a lot more understood and where I used to work on more the institutional investment banking research side than it is on the individual side. But for people who understand that, you can take advantage of combinations of liabilities and inflation to just make massive sums of money. And with individuals, we have far fewer options, but at least at this point, mortgages are a very good way of doing it.
Because mortgages are, they're not only cheap, they're actually better than free. You're getting paid to borrow the money. You know, Dan, you'll appreciate this more than most people I know. We had a client on the show a few weeks ago, and he just purchased a property through our network. His interest rate was 3.5%, or I think it was 3.75% for three decades fixed. We had another client, by the way, that just got 2.99 on a personal residence. You can't quite do that on an investment investment property. But we looked at your taxation, your almost 100% interest in the beginning of that amortized loan. So your taxes are about 1.75%. And if the inflation rate is 2%, you're literally getting paid to borrow the money, even if you never rent the property out. Isn't that just a miracle?
It is. And it's an unfair miracle.
Yeah.
But it's something we can tap into in a few ways. And that's one of the few ways an individual can do it.
Absolutely. And it's one of the reasons the rich get richer, unfortunately. You know, it's not fair, but it is the way it is. So
yeah. What's happening, if you look in the last few weeks, is that we're seeing a lifetime change happening where there's a realignment towards that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we're going to have a much larger national debt. The Federal Reserve is going to have a much larger balance sheet. They're going to attempt to manage the situation and economic recovery with extremely low interest rates. And there's virtually no way out of that scenario. Plus, there's very strong benefits from the perspective of a heavily indebted nation to engage in what's called financial repression, which is where you have as a very deliberate matter of national policy. Many nations have done this many decades. You have interest rates that are below the rate of inflation. That becomes a dominant influence for a generation at a time. And it sure seems like we're moving really fast there.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. Dan, it's always so interesting to talk to you. Folks, again, you can get that free book at his website. And wrap it up for us with just anything else you want everybody to know.
I think that takes care of it. It's okay. Good talking with you as always, Jason.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Happy investing.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.